What a page to turn to, the Aleppo Codex. Considered the perfect version of the Hebrew scriptures, and in particular, the most important part, the first five books of the Bible, known as the Pentateuch. Well, we're going to talk about the missing pages of the Aleppo Codex, this book which had existed in the town of Aleppo, Syria, for 600 years before anti-Israel rioting in 1948 burned the synagogue down that had contained the Aleppo Codex. It had, however, survived. It was in hiding, and it reappears in 1957. Maddie Friedman was in the middle of telling us the story of how he was being introduced to aspects of the history of the Aleppo Codex through the recollections of a former Mossad agent. He was telling that story. We'll get back to it. We'll pick it up right up there in just a second. But we'll get into more of the missing pages of the Aleppo Codex and the story of its mysterious power next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So Maddie Friedman kind of got on the trail of the Aleppo Codex when he was writing about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And when he came across this book, he wrote about it, had found out that he'd been sort of fed false information, that there was kind of an active disinformation campaign still out there to keep people from knowing the real story of the Aleppo Codex and how it ended up in Jerusalem, and where it had been and some of the missing pages. We'll get to that coming up in just a minute. So Maddie, you were saying you were meeting with this former Mossad agent as he was looking you in the eye, and you were trying to get him to tell you the story of the Aleppo Codex, and he was being what a good agent was. He was controlling the conversation.
That's certainly true. The agent's name was Rafi Sutton, and he, as I mentioned, had spent many years in the Mossad and in other Israeli intelligence arms, and he had served in Europe and had served in places in the Arab world, and he had a long and storied career and was almost 80 years old, but was nonetheless a very intimidating character. And he was meeting me in his living room, and he placed on the coffee table a file folder that was full of old documents. And of course, for a reporter, there are few things as mouth-watering as an old file folder full of documents. And it took a few minutes before I understood that he actually had no intention of letting me see what was inside the file folder. Experienced agents don't just give away information. They don't give you information for free. You have to, bargain for it. You have to show them that you really want it. You have to show them that you deserve it. And it took a few more meetings, actually, before Sutton actually let me glimpse inside the file folder. And indeed, it did contain some very interesting information that helped me put the story together.
I love that. And you were warned. You were even given a warning that this may be an impossible story for you to report, that if you answered questions wrong, that the entire community of people that knew about the Aleppo Codex would totally freeze you out.
One of the people involved in the story is a guy named Ezra Kassin, who had kind of run almost a private investigation into the story of the Aleppo Codex over a number of years, and it was hoarding documents and information in a room in his apartment in binders and on his computer. Basically been a private investigator, and he'd been doing this on his own time, and he warned me right at the beginning. By the way, he also wouldn't give me information at first. And he eventually became a very close collaborator and ally, but he warned me right at the beginning that if you say one wrong thing to someone, 10 other doors will slam shut. So you have to be very, very careful as you make your way through the story not to antagonize people, not to tick people off about what you know, not to make people suspicious, to be very, very careful. And that was one of the more challenging parts of the investigation, which lasted several years and did end with me gleaning a lot of information about the Aleppo Codex that had never been published before, and it has now been published in my book, which is called the Aleppo Codex.
Yeah, it's really a great read. So, you know, it's a history book, but it's also, you know, as you recount your efforts to get the story told, and then we are introduced to the people that actually helped save it, in many cases, many of whom are still alive. It's fascinating, and just nice rotation on the chapters and in following the main story, but all of the subplots as well in this nonfiction account about this important ancient Bible. So the Aleppo Codex, then, as you find out more and more about it, you find out that the copy that exists in Israel today, still very important, but it's been damaged. So talk about the damage that happened to it and the pages that are missing.
That's right. The copy that exists in the Israel Museum today in 2012 consists of 295 parchment pages. The Aleppo Codex, as it was written in Tiberias in 930 AD, consisted of 500 parchment pages. So we're missing about 200 pages. We're missing about 40% of the manuscript. And the part that is missing includes, as we've mentioned, the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, the heart of the Hebrew Bible, which is called the Torah. Those books aren't there. And other books are missing as well, including Ecclesiastes and Daniel and Esther. And there are chunks of the manuscript missing from the middle and individual pages, all told about 200. And the question of where those pages are and how they went missing is a matter of great interest to people who are interested in Bible scholarship and in the perfection of the text of the Hebrew Bible. Of course, it's also a matter of interest for exiles from Jewish Aleppo. And I found that there was kind of an underground of people. I called them in the book the Aleppo Codex Underground, a small group of people who were very interested in this manuscript and whose eyes would light up if you mentioned it. And these people, some of them had been pursuing the missing pages for many, many, many years. There's been a search underway for those pages since the late 1950s. And the question of where they are and how they vanished is very, very interesting. The answers that I uncovered were surprising to me. They're not at all what I expected when I set out.
Well, let's get to some of that here, because as we were telling the story, this book, this near perfect copy, well, the perfect copy of the Hebrew scriptures, it was known to be exactly the way it had been when Maimonides was using it for his studies and commentary in the Middle Ages. And here it is in Aleppo, Syria. Then the rioting starts. Then the book disappears, has to be hidden away from those people who would seek to destroy it, or to sell it, or to do whatever. When do we think pages or whole chapters start to go missing?
That's a very interesting question, and it's worth dwelling on it for a few seconds. The Aleppo Codex had survived more than 1,000 years of very turbulent history. As we mentioned, it was stolen by the Crusaders. It survived the Crusader conquest of Jerusalem, which was incredibly violent. There were massacres, and there were fires in Jerusalem. It ends up in Cairo. It traveled across the desert, goes down to Egypt in the 11th century, and then travels north to Aleppo. And it's in Aleppo when the Mongols conquer Aleppo. It survives an earthquake that kills a large portion of the population of Aleppo. And in the mid-20th century, the Aleppo Codex is in something close to perfect condition.
Well, and we should probably mention, too, it survived World War II, which is even surprising in and of itself, in that the government of Syria was, or at least the leaders of Syria, were pro-Nazi. And that most of the Arab world of that time was pro-Nazi, and that the Arabs and the Nazis had been collaborating on recovering a lot of these artifacts, which Hitler and Goebbels and Himmler, other people, were fascinated with getting their hands on these on all of these ancient artifacts, kind of what the core of the Raiders of the Lost Ark was about. And somehow the Aleppo Codex doesn't end up in Nazi hands. That in itself is kind of its own little miracle.
It is kind of a miracle. Syria at the time is ruled at the beginning of World War II by the Vichy French, the collaborationist French regime, the pro-Nazi French regime. And that ends when the Allies invade and Commonwealth forces arrive in Syria. But of course, Nazi forces are advancing through North Africa, and there is some concern that the entire Middle East is going to fall into Nazi hands. And the Nazis are finally stopped in that famous battle at El Alamein. And had they continued to advance, it, as you say, I mean, we can only imagine what might have happened to the Codex.
Or even if the Vichy government had just handed it over, had just come in because, you know, they had handed over, they were putting Jews on train cars throughout, you know, France. So, I mean, it wouldn't have been surprising to think they would have just come in, cleaned out Aleppo, you know, to not, I don't mean that in the sense that that would have been cleaning, but ethnically cleansing Aleppo, and along the way, handing over the prize of the Aleppo Codex to Adolf Hitler.
That's true, and that's certainly another danger that the Codex somehow manages to get through. I mean, in the First World War, the Ottoman Empire, which controlled Aleppo and the rest of the Middle East, collapses, and European powers come, and then there's the upheaval around the Second World War. And after the Second World War, after all of these incredible events that the Aleppo Codex has seen, the Codex is in more or less perfect condition. And that is just a testament to its guardians, who managed to keep it safe through centuries and centuries of a very very turbulent history. Part of it was the stories that they had woven around the Codex to protect it, because the Jewish people, they're never in power. It's not like in Europe where you'd have endowed monasteries or royal libraries. There's no political power protecting the book. It's just this small minority community and its beliefs, and they had somehow managed to navigate all the upheaval in the Middle East, and they managed to keep the book safe for 1,000 years, and it was in more or less perfect condition in the 1940s. A scholar sees it in 1943, actually, a scholar who'd been dispatched from Jerusalem. The leadership in Jerusalem, a circle of scholars in Jerusalem, were very interested in the Aleppo Codex. One of the scholars was Yitzhak Ben Zvi, who I imagine we'll get back to later, who would go on to be the president of Israel. And in 1943, he made an attempt to obtain the Aleppo Codex from the Jewish leadership in Aleppo, and he sent an envoy to ask for the book. And of course, they said, no way, because they would never part with their greatest spiritual possession. He sent another envoy to ask them for permission to photograph it, and they said, no way, because if photographs exist, or so they existed, or so they believed, that would cheapen the manuscript. If there were facsimiles circulating, no one would need them, and no one would need the original. So they turned down the request for photography, and in the end, they agreed to let a scholar sit with the manuscript for several hours over a period of several days. And a scholar sits with it in 1943 at the height of the Second World War, and the manuscript is complete. And when I set out to investigate the story, and the official version of the story was that the pages had gone missing around the time of the riot in 1947. And there was, for many years, the accepted story, and you still hear it, even though it's been debunked. It's probably still the most prevalent explanation for the disappearance of the pages, was that the pages were burned in the fire. When the Codex shows up in Israel in 1957, there are strange marks on the bottom outer corners of the pages, of all of the pages of the Codex, and they're kind of a weird brownish, purplish color, and the pages are eaten a bit on the corner. And it looks like a burn mark. And the story is that the Codex was singed in the fire. And, of course, we do know that the synagogue was burned and that 200 pages were eaten by the flames and the rest of the Codex was rescued. And this becomes the accepted version of the story. And it's also a very neat story because then you don't have to investigate what happened. They were simply burned and no one is to blame.
And burned by non-Jews.
And burned by Muslim rioters who were inflamed by this UN decision. In 1986, the Codex is sent for restoration at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. And the manuscript expert at the museum thinks that these burn marks look strange. He's seen a lot of parchment, and he's seen burned parchment, and something just doesn't look right to him. Together with a microbiologist, also in Jerusalem, and with a few scientists who are actually in Albany, New York, they run a battery of tests on the manuscript, and the tests are sent back to Jerusalem, and the manuscript expert at the museum told me that when he got the slides, the microscope slides, back from the lab, he actually jumped out of his chair because the results of the test were very clear that the burn mark was, the burn mark in quotes, was a fungus. It wasn't a burn mark at all. And in fact, there were no signs whatsoever that the manuscript had been burned in 1947.
Ever.
Had ever.
Ever. That's so amazing.
And that, of course, revives the question, because if the manuscript hadn't been burned, then where on earth were its 200 missing pages?
And we are to presume that those 200 pages weren't eaten by a fungus.
That's right. They were not eaten by a fungus, and they were not eaten by a fire. So what options are left? When I began looking into the story, the official story, that, by the way, is still widely believed. You'll still see it pop up in references to Depo Codex. Even there was an article that I saw from 2010 that references the fire story. That's still very, very prevalent, even though it was debunked in the 1980s. The official version of the story, when I began looking into it, had been altered slightly. The way the pages had disappeared had been altered. The time frame had not been altered. The official version was that immediately after the riot in Aleppo, Jews from Aleppo came to the synagogue and picked up pieces of the Codex as souvenirs and spirited them out of Syria when they left Syria. And the reason that this story existed is also very interesting. Two of the missing pieces of the Aleppo Codex have actually surfaced. One was a full page from the Book of Chronicles, and one was a small torn fragment from the Book of Exodus. And both of these pages surfaced in the 1980s in Brooklyn, New York. And they surfaced in the possession of Jews from Aleppo who had fled Syria, as all of the Jews of Syria did, and who ended up in New York City. The fragment from the Book of Exodus had been laminated and was kept in the wallet of an old man from Aleppo who kept it as a good luck charm and who believed it protected him. And who believed that it had helped him survive open heart surgery. So we see that this belief, the community's ancient belief that the manuscript protected the community, had kind of morphed into a belief that the fragments of the Aleppo Codex can protect individual members of the community. It was still protecting them, even though the community had been lost. And this, it was thought, was the key to understanding the mystery of the missing pages. And that's what I believed when I started writing.
All the more amazing that that didn't fall into Nazi hands, as they were fascinated with mystical talisman that could protect their troops or protect their efforts, and they would take that power wherever they could find it. But to go back then to the provenance of this, during the time that it's being eaten away by a fungus, or when chapters and pages go missing, in whose hands is the Aleppo Codex?
That is also a more complicated question than it would seem. The official story then, as I start out, is that the pages went missing around the time of the riot in Aleppo in 1947. But if you start digging deeper into the documentary record and into witness testimony, it becomes quite clear that the Codex was seen whole by reliable witnesses 5 years after the riot, 1952. That is a very strange testimony. We have testimony from someone who saw the manuscript the morning after the riot, and it was filmed. He was filmed. He has since passed away, but he was filmed in 1989. Was very lucky. We have testimony from someone who saw the Codex several weeks after the riot. He was interviewed by an Israeli diplomat in Rio de Janeiro in the early 1960s, and that testimony survives in print. And those two witnesses agree that the Codex was whole, except for a very small number of pages, perhaps a dozen pages, after the riot. And the most striking testimony it comes from 1952, when one of the most respected Aleppo rabbis visited the manuscript in its hiding place in Aleppo before he left Aleppo. And he saw a manuscript that was whole except for a small number of pages. And that very much shifts the time frame for the disappearance of the pages, because it did not, the missing pieces or the bulk of the missing pieces did not go missing in the riot. They went missing later.
Well, we'll hang on to that, and we'll continue here, because it's not just the number of pages, it's which pages, are still not returned. Next on Coast to Coast. So the Aleppo Codex, this perfect copy of the Bible, exists for a millennia before the end of World War II, when suddenly it's in flux. It ends up in Israel, but not before whole chapters have been taken. Who took those chapters? Why did they take those chapters? Where are they now? Who do we think has them? When would the Aleppo Codex, how could the Aleppo Codex be returned to its original state of perfection? And who doesn't want it to be? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So, Maddie Freeman, it would seem to reason that there would be a national push in Israel, within all of Judaica, to get the Aleppo Codex restored to its original state. I mean, that there would be a huge effort, almost a kind of international shaming on anybody that had a fragment, a page, or a chapter from the Aleppo Codex to return it so that the book can once more be the way it was when, for example, Maimonides used it for his scholarship on the Hebrew scriptures.
Yes, that would be a logical explanation. There have been efforts to reconstitute the Codex. None of them have been particularly serious. There's never been a government-sponsored investigation with real teeth into what might have happened to the Codex. And 50, more than 50 years after the Codex arrived in Israel, mysteriously incomplete, the Codex is still incomplete, and all we have are those two fragments that I mentioned that surfaced in Brooklyn, both of which have been sent to Jerusalem to join the rest of the manuscript. But we're still missing about 200 pages, and as we've mentioned, those pages include the most important part of the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, or the five books of Moses.
The first five books of the Bible. So who do we think has them?
Well, in the book, I do two things. I go snooping around to see who might have pieces of the Aleppo Codex, and I also try to find out when and how those pieces might have gone missing. Now, if you find yourself snooping around the story of the Aleppo Codex, you'll hear stories about pieces circulating in Aleppo Jewish communities. These are very common stories, kind of inspired by these two fragments that surfaced that were being held as good luck charms in Brooklyn, New York. And these stories, which are usually go something along these lines. Someone will say, oh, you're interested in the Aleppo Codex? I know someone who has a piece of the Aleppo Codex. And then if you scratch a bit deeper, you'll find that it's probably someone who knows someone who has a piece of the Aleppo Codex, and those avenues of inquiry usually end with someone who isn't willing to talk. And you can spend a lot of time chasing those kind of rumors. It's not a very rewarding avenue of inquiry in the story of the Aleppo Codex. And none of these fragments supposedly being held by Aleppo Jews have surfaced since 1986. That's a very, very long time.
But the idea here is almost like it's almost like a piece of their hometown, that no matter where they went, they were tied back to Aleppo, Syria, with a fragment of the book to go with them.
That is it. That is exactly it.
Okay. I mean,
Aleppo, this ancient Jewish community of Aleppo, which was famous, and it was kind of in many ways the flagship Jewish community of the Middle East, Aleppo has been lost, and their whole world was lost, but they can have a connection to that world through the pieces of the book that had always symbolized the community. And that's a very interesting and powerful phenomenon. However, there are rumors of a larger section of the Codex that has been said to be circulating. And that's far more interesting than chasing little pieces which may or may not be held by individual people. There's a story that I encountered about a large section of the Aleppo Codex, which was on the black market in Jerusalem in the 1980s. And I spent quite a lot of time investigating that story, which led me to a fascinating character, a collector, both almost 90 years old, one of the most prominent collectors of biblical antiquities in the world, who splits his time between a luxury suite here in Israel and an apartment in London, England. And I interviewed him here, and eventually I also pursued him to London, hoping that he would divulge the information that he has about missing pieces of the Bible Codex. And in the end, he did divulge quite a lot of information, and I could reconstruct the story of this section of the Codex, which, according to the collector, was offered to him in a hotel lobby in Jerusalem in 1985. And that ends up being a very interesting story for several reasons, both because it gives us an indication of where the pieces of the Codex might be, and without giving away too much, because I don't want to give away too much of the solution to the mystery. But let's just say that I taped conversations with this collector, and the transcripts give us good reason to think that he might be, but let's just say, firmly connected to the story of the missing pages of the Aleppo Codex, and that anyone undertaking a search for the missing pages of the Aleppo Codex might want to start with him. But the story of the sale, or the attempted sale to him, of a section of the Aleppo Codex that, according to him, consisted of around 90 pages and consisted of the five books of Moses, which are really the holy grail for people interested in the missing pages, ends up being even more interesting because the dealer, he was approached by two men, according to this collector, two men in the lobby of the Hilton Hotel in Jerusalem in 1985. The primary dealer, who he said had offered him part of the Codex, I had obviously hoped to interview him. I was going to track him down. I wanted to find out who had held the manuscript so that I could then find them and ask where they had obtained the manuscript from, which I should note is a very difficult thing to do. The trade in antiquities is impossibly, opaque. It's completely murky. You can't figure out where anything's coming from or where it's going. And as I write in the book, it's kind of looking for the Aleppo Codex in the black market. It's kind of like looking for gold by staring at the ground. You're not going to find anything. But the dealer who had offered the Codex to this collector was murdered several years later in another hotel in Jerusalem, the Plaza Hotel, in room 915, in a story that garnered quite a bit of press attention at the time. That was 1989. Of course, he is not available for interviews.
There's more to all of that in the book, The Aleppo Codex. You can find out more by going to coasttocoastam.com. So worth the read. But then, in a way, this what you just said kind of brings us full circle to something I talked about before we got going with the story of your codex, and that's the story of the Jordanian codex, which is an interesting kind of A-B comparison. We've been covering that story a lot on Coast to Coast. We talked to some of the principals involved. That is sort of like the, in a way, it's kind of the opposite of your story, in that so all these books started popping up. Are you familiar with the story I'm referring to?
The bare bones of the story. You're talking about the text that pop up. They're written on some kind of metal, as far as I remember.
Some of them are metal.
They may or may not be forgeries.
Yeah, some of them are lead. Some of them are vellum, but most of them were in rusty pages. Mm-hmm. And this is a collection of books that were supposedly found in a cave, sounding a little bit like the Dead Sea Scrolls story. I think several, if not all, scholars so far are pointing to these as forgeries. But what's interesting, so this is a story that's sort of developing about a year ago. And I think it speaks to the idea of you can't quite know the origin of some of these things. It looks bogus. I mean, it just seems impossible to think that these books just kind of popped up out of nowhere and that they are from what scholars refer to as the intertestamental period of the first century. And so some of these books of the Jordanian codices are Hebrew in origin. I mean, they're part of the last period before the destruction of the temple. And some of them seem to have early indications of this breakaway sect of Jesus following Jews who are starting to write about their experience separately from, you know, the collective Jewish experience. And so there's, it seems to be from that period, but everybody's pointing to them as fake. But that's the part that's so interesting about this, because you really, you know, it's like, first you can't, you hear the differing versions of the origin of these. And that's what happened too with the story of how the Aleppo Codex ended up in Jerusalem. There's 5 different or 20 different stories of the night that it was supposedly destroyed and who was the last person to see it. And so it's kind of, you never quite, can't quite always tell exactly who's telling the truth.
That's certainly a symptom of that, of the murky market in antiquities. I mean, and it's really a curse of this whole subject, because you have the most amazing stuff that's popping up that's genuine. And the, you know, classic example are the Gnostic Gospels that appeared, and which are, right, are genuine, which are just fantastic. And you have the most amazing antiquities that are totally real. And because there's such a thriving market in forged antiquities, which is driven by this demand for them, people want physical artifacts that connect them to the stories of the Bible, and they want it so badly that they're willing to pay a lot of money for it. And the second that a lot of money is involved, there are people willing to produce what people want. And it's hard, and this seems to be the story of the Jordanian documents that have surfaced. It ends up being very hard to know what's real and what's not. There was a fascinating trial that just ended in Jerusalem around the James ossuary. Which is
right,
it ends up being a trial for the forgery of biblical antiquities. And the question,
all right,
was,
let's set that up for people that may not remember, because there's a strong connection also in the show to the so-called James ossuary. Yeah. This is the bone box of what would have been the brother of Jesus. And that's what it said. That's what it seemed to be inscribed on the side of this stone box, where after the body had all of the flesh had been taken from the bones themselves were then put into this box. And that's the ossuary that was discovered underneath the city of Jerusalem, right? I mean, it was actually found in an old tomb.
Well, that's part of the problem. We don't
okay,
know
or
where
was it
discovered.
Right.
It surfaces in a shop. So as soon as an artifact is discovered, not in situ, not in an actual archaeological site, but rather on the market, it becomes impossible to know where it came from, and it also becomes impossible to know if it's real. So we have this incredible stone box, which says, in a Hebrew inscription on the side, it says, James, brother of Jesus. And if it's talking about the same James, who's the brother of the same Jesus, that is quite an incredible artifact. But many scholars came to believe that this artifact was fake, and it became the focus of a very interesting trial that just ended in Jerusalem, in which the guy who had been accused of faking it was acquitted, because there are scholars who do not believe that it is fake, and the government, which was prosecuting the accused forger, could not prove its case. And now no one really knows. So with a lot of this stuff, you end up not really knowing. Now, in the case of the Aleppo Codex, we know that this is the Aleppo Codex. We know that it's the genuine
right.
article. We don't have any of these issues, but certainly the trade is very, very murky. And the second, you know, as soon as these artifacts become worth a lot of money, then things get dirty and people get involved who do not have pure motives. And of course, the irony in this story is that we're talking about the book that tells us not to do that. I mean, we're talking about the book that exists basically to raise us from anarchy into law and to teach us that the physical world is not everything, that there are things beyond the physical world. And, of course, this book becomes, you know, it gets sucked into our very human preoccupation with physical objects and money.
Yeah, the Aleppo Codex, like some of those... like some of the Gnostic Gospels, at least we know that the Aleppo Codex was written about, so we can see it, you know, being referred to throughout history, and so we know it exists. It's kind of like the same thing with a lot of the Gnostic Gospels. there were references to their existence. The copies weren't necessarily available. So that's what makes it an interesting discovery later on, is suddenly these Gospels appear, and they appear with the title of something that had existed, you know, that had been referenced before. Whether that's the exact same thing that was being referenced or whether it just has the same title, again, it sort of like goes back to the murkiness of Middle Eastern scholarship on this. But the Aleppo Codex at least is clear. What's less clear then is the future of the Codex. So is your hope for this book that we're going to finally there's going to be an effort to bring all of the pages back together again, and that'll be sort of a national effort to restore the Aleppo Codex?
I would certainly like to see one. I hope the publication of this book, the Aleppo Codex, will revive interest in this manuscript, which has basically been dormant for many, many years. It hasn't drawn any significant interest in many years. And in those years since it was last written about, things have changed. People have died, things change hands, and I'm hoping that with increased interest in the Codex, perhaps new information will arise. I'm not optimistic about there being an official inquiry into the...
But why is that? Is that because the government knows that some of the people who have pages or whole books got them, you know, illegally or immorally, and they don't want to incriminate powerful people?
I will say, again, without giving away too much of the solution to the mystery, which is...
Yes, yeah, I didn't finish that part of the book.
That the story of the missing pages, the reason that it has never been told until now, and the reason that it hasn't been properly investigated until now, is because the story of the disappearance of the missing pages could well implicate bodies and people in Israel. The official version that the pages disappeared around the time of the riot in Aleppo isn't true, and it is certainly possible that the pages vanished in Israel. And get much more specific in the book about scenarios in which they could disappear. But people haven't been interested in digging too deep into that story for that reason.
All right, now I'm going to dig a little bit deeper, and here's why. I'm going to allow you to get away with a little bit of that, because I appreciate the end of the mystery, although usually we kind of press people to, like, tell the whole story.
Well,
and it won't hurt your book sales, I promise. But because I haven't gotten to that part of the book yet, I can't give that away. Or I got, like, right up to that part. I know right what you're referring to, and that's where I stopped reading earlier this afternoon. But I'll get to that. But is it because powerful people that formed Israel, that some of the, let's say, a former scholar who became a president of Israel, and because of other people that are at the top of the formation of Israel, that they took a slice of the Aleppo Codex? Is that why it's never going to be investigated?
Well, that's something I can definitely talk about without giving too much away. There are two mysteries connected to the Aleppo Codex. One is the mystery we've already discussed, which is the disappearance of the missing pages. And the other mystery is how the Codex got to Israel. We haven't really touched on that yet. And that's a mystery that is, in my opinion, equally interesting, because the story of how it reached Israel ends up being a very exciting story. It involves a Syrian Jew who smuggled the Codex out of Syria in his washing machine and into Turkey and from there to Israel. And there's an official version of that story which has also been neatened up, because it does implicate the figure who you mentioned, the scholar who then went on to be president of Israel, Yitzhak Ben Tzvi. The official version of how the Codex went to Israel is, which you'll still find in books and in museum labels, is that the Aleppo rabbis in 1957 understood that their community was dying and realized that the Codex had to be sent out of Syria, which flew in the face of centuries of tradition, that the Codex could not be moved, but there was no choice. So they sent it with this courier who hid it in his washing machine and instructed him to turn the manuscript over to Ben Tzvi, who was the president at that time. That's the official story. That story isn't true. The real story involves the interception of the courier in Turkey by Israeli agents in 1957. And the instructions that were given to the courier were quite different than the instructions that exist in the official version of the story. Bensley did obtain the codex, and to this day it is held by the institute that he founded, which is called the Bensley Institute. Until this day, they're the custodians of the manuscript. And the story of how the institute, effectively the state of Israel, because it's a government institute and the codex today is effectively the property of the Israeli government, sort of how the government obtained the manuscript ends up being very, very interesting.
And yeah, it was.
A trial that stretches over 4 years and does implicate people in Israel's leadership. And that is why this story has never been told. Similarly, the answer to the mystery of the missing pages also may well implicate high-ranking people in the government and people certainly in the academic world.
And that's where we'll leave it till we'll start taking calls. Maddie Friedman, the Aleppo Codex. I hope you found this as fascinating as I have. We'll get to your calls next on Coast to Coast.